Hi, everyone. So I would like to read this poem just one more time. If I keep telling myself I'm afraid, that's all I'll ever be. I don't want to be this person, wrapped up in my own unchanging narratives. I need to remember the pollination my wings carry, the honey smeared on my lips, my bright yellow skin. I need to remember my body as something tied everywhere to the ground, not by rope, but by something like stars, something like spirit. I need to remember that I have roots, sprouting and spiraling, dreaming and creating. This poem was actually written by my daughter, Maya. She's 21 now. She's an absolutely amazing writer, and she's an amazing poet. She'll make these little chapbooks with poems that she's been writing. She always gives them to me. And then she'll always ask me, oh, have you read my chapbook? And I says, well, I find it really hard to read, because whenever I pick up your chapbook and I start reading a poem, the first poem I read will kind of stop me in my tracks, so I never get very far. Yeah. So this particular poem, it just struck me right away, this notion of the stories that we tell ourselves. Yeah. If I keep telling myself, fill in the blank. And in my daughter's case, Maya's case, the sense of like, if I keep telling myself that I'm afraid. Yeah. So we've all got these stories that we carry with us, these stories that define who we are. Some of these stories we like, some of these stories we don't like. And this is what I'm referring to as the circus of the mind. Oh, the places that my mind gets up to. So from a technical standpoint, from a Buddhist standpoint, what this little turn of phrase is pointing at, the circus of the mind, is pointing at this word called prapancha. Prapancha. And this word is commonly translated as mental proliferation, which is an okay definition. It's an okay translation. But really what this word is mental proliferation, and it has a very clear negative connotation. So it's negative, it's constricting, it complicates. It's mental proliferation that complicates, it distorts, it exaggerates, it falsifies. And this is the definition I pulled out of the Pali English Dictionary online. Prapancha is the tendency of the mind to proliferate issues from the sense of I am the thinker. Yes, I am the thinker. Right. So some very common thinking, mental proliferation, can revolve around, I'm not good enough, like I'm a fraud, am I doing this right, I must be doing this wrong, I'm not lovable, nobody likes me, that sort of thing, I'm an idiot, I'm stupid, I'm no good, all these things. These are just the stories that we tell ourselves, and they actually bind us to suffering. So in the Pali Canon, this type of mental proliferation, it's represented symbolically, metaphorically, by this one figure in the Pali Canon called Mara. Mara is a really interesting character because Mara keeps appearing throughout the Pali Canon. And it's a bit of a trickster, actually. So the most famous story in the Pali Canon about Mara is when the Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha Gautama, is on the cusp of enlightenment. So Siddhartha decides that he's ready, the conditions are aligned, and he sits underneath this tree, the Bodhi tree, and he basically makes this commitment to himself that I will not rise from this seat until full liberation arises. And when he's sitting and he's exerting himself with great effort, here comes Mara. So Mara is the voice of doubt, the voice of, just trying to talk you out of whatever it is that you're trying to do. This is actually what Mara says. So Mara meets the Buddha, he sees the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, "Oh, you are thin and you are pale, and you are in death's presence too. 1,000 parts are pledged to death, but life still holds one part of you. Live, sir. Life is the better way. You can gain merit if you live. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling, too, is rough and difficult and hard to bear." So what comes to mind when I set my alarm to get up early to meditate? The alarm goes off, and I'm all cozy in bed, and there's just a voice in my head going, "Oh, it's so comfortable. Oh, I'll just sleep for another 10 minutes. That's fine. That's no big deal." And this is essentially what Mara is saying to the Buddha. Right? Why all the struggle? What's the point? So Siddhartha, he sees Mara for who Mara is. It's just his voice in his head. And the Buddha actually, or the Buddha-to-be, just simply chooses to not be swayed by this voice, to simply not respond to it. The Buddha-to-be simply recognizes this voice as completely without merit. There's no stickiness to it. It's interesting with this story because there's lots of poetic license that's been added to this story. So in this story, you know, Mara then attacks the Buddha with armies, with all his different armies. And all these monsters and evil demons are shooting arrows and throwing clubs at the Buddha-to-be. And as these weapons approach him, they all turn to flowers. So then Mara tries another tact. Mara then sends his three daughters to try and seduce the Buddha. And once again, the Buddha-to-be is unswayed. So then Mara tries a different tact. He basically says to the Buddha-to-be, he challenges the Buddha and says, "What right do you have to sit here? What right do you have to become fully awake?" Siddhartha says, "I have practiced generosity for lifetimes, for many, many lifetimes." And Mara says to the Buddha, "Well, who is your witness? Who has seen this?" And this is where the Buddha reaches down and touches the earth. And then the earth actually shakes, it shivers. And in the later tradition, there's a story where the earth goddess rises out of the earth. Only that the top part of the earth goddess is above ground and the rest of her body is below. And the earth goddess bears witness to this scene. And when this happens, Mara feels completely defeated and just simply disappears. This whole story, a lot of the parts of the story actually don't appear in the Pali Canon. They've been added in the later tradition. But it's still a beautiful story. So this is actually what the Buddha does say to Mara when Mara approaches. And Gautama says this to Mara. Your first squadron is sense desires. Your second is called boredom. Then hunger and thirst compose the third, and craving is the fourth in rank. The fifth is sloth and torpor, while cowardice lines up as sixth. Uncertainty is seventh, and eighth is malice paired with obstinacy. These are your squadrons, Mara the evil one. So the Buddha just simply sees clearly what Mara represents and what Mara does. So then the Buddha goes on to become fully enlightened, fully liberated. So then the really interesting thing that happens in the Pali Canon is that even after the Buddha becomes fully enlightened, Mara still comes to visit the Buddha, still tries to trick the Buddha. And the Buddha always, right away, sees Mara for who Mara is and is completely unswayed by Mara, which then immediately causes Mara to slink away in defeat and despair. I'll share a couple stories where this happens. Right, so there's this one story from the Pali Canon where the Buddha gets a stone sliver stuck in his foot. Let's see, it goes like this. At the time, the Buddha's foot had been pierced by a stone sliver. Excruciating were the bodily feelings that developed within him. Painful, fierce, sharp, racking, repellent, disagreeable. But he endured them, mindful, alert, and unperturbed. So then Mara sees this. He sees the Buddha lying down. So here comes Mara. And this is what Mara says to the Buddha. You are lying there in a stupor. Are you lying there in a stupor or drunk on poetry? Are your goals so few, all alone in a secluded lodging? What is the dreamer, this sleepy face? So he kind of taunts the Buddha. It's kind of funny, you know? And the Buddha just immediately responds, completely equanimous, completely unperturbed. And the Buddha just says, I lie here, not in a stupor, not drunk on poetry. My goal is attained, and I am sorrow-free. All alone in a secluded lodging, I lie down with sympathy for all beings. And he just goes on from there. And the same thing happens in numerous occasions where then Mara, sad and dejected, realizing the Blessed One knows me, the Blessed One has seen me for who I am, and then vanishes right then and there. So this image comes up of drops of water rolling off the back of a duck. So this Mara, these voices in our head, we don't necessarily have to believe everything that we think, especially those voices that feel really quite harsh, quite unkind, and clearly are really unkind. What is the path forward? How do we actually tame the demon of Mara? How do we do this? And it's interesting, going back to this poem, I need to remember the pollination my wings carry, the honey smeared on my lips, my bright yellow skin. I need to remember my body as something tied everywhere to the ground, not by rope, but by something like stars, something like my spirit. I need to remember that I have roots, sprouting and spiraling, dreaming and creating. So the key is to see the nature of our thoughts, the nature of our stories, the nature of our narratives. Our narratives are completely ephemeral. They're completely empty, to use a Buddhist term. They have no inherent truth or inherent meaning to them. And ultimately, our minds are completely flexible, completely malleable. So the purity of mind, what this is pointing at, is that nothing can actually stick to it. It's just like all of these things that arise, that seem to give us so much trouble, that seem to complicate our life so much. We can just simply imagine them as drops of water rolling off the back of a duck. So now this is much easier said than done. It's actually very hard to remember. It's very, very hard to remember. One way that I like to remember is through the use of slogans. So this little turn of phrase, the circus of the mind, I actually picked this up from a friend of mine. We were having a conversation about setting healthy boundaries. We were sharing stories about some toxic people in our lives. And how do you deal with it? And she taught me this little slogan. She says to herself, oh yeah, well, when I'm dealing with this particular person and this person is kind of blah all over, she'll just say to herself in her mind, Not my monkeys, not my circus, not my monkeys. Go on, go on, run along. And I love this turn of phrase, you know, not my monkeys, not my circus. And it's so interesting, the power of narratives. In the same way, if you keep telling yourself that I'm afraid, you'll just continue to be afraid. So just that fact alone is a doorway. So in the same way, we can keep telling ourselves that we're no good. We can also keep telling ourselves that we actually are good. We can tell ourselves a different story. And actually, the more we tell this story, actually, the more we tell whatever story it is that we're telling, the more we will become that story. So what Buddhism suggests is knowing that the mind is pure in its essence, knowing that the mind is malleable and flexible in its essence, knowing that these stories are completely ephemeral, why don't we tell ourselves good stories? Why not? It's very powerful to tell yourself good stories. Yeah. Matter of fact, this is something that my son does. He does this in the mornings. Well, they're both 21. Both my kids are 21. And they both are experiencing completely age-appropriate anxiety. And it is at amped up, level 11. Yeah. It's crazy, actually. It's painful, actually, to watch it. What my son does is, on the mirror in the bathroom, he's got some sticky notes with these little affirmations. I am loved. I am whole. I am held. Something like that. I forget exactly what they are. And he says every morning when he gets up, brushes his teeth, and he just sees these affirmations on his mirror, and he reads them out loud. And I asked him, oh, so does it work? How does that affect you? And he said, oh, it definitely works. It definitely works. It's like, oh, I should try that. Yeah, it's quite interesting. So this is also what is referred to by these two stanzas from the Dhammapada. Mind is the forerunner of all actions. All deeds are led by mind, created by mind. If one speaks or acts with a corrupt mind, suffering follows, as the wheel follows the hoof of an ox pulling a cart. Mind is the forerunner of all actions. All deeds are led by mind, created by mind. If one speaks or acts with a serene mind, happiness follows, as surely as one's shadow. So this line, all deeds are led by mind, created by mind. All deeds are created by mind. There's a lot to this line. All deeds are created by mind. So I think we all have a sense of this, I imagine. So when we're feeling frustrated or angry, whatever it may be, I think we all have a sense of when we act from that place, that the energy that we're projecting outward into the world can be kind of harsh, can be unkind. So our mental states very strongly affect our actions in the world. And according to Buddhism, our mental states are our actions in the world. It's everything, our mental states. So the other aspect of Mara is Mara also likes to get us to ignore what's most important. Mara likes to keep us bound to samsara, keep us bound to suffering. So it's quite interesting, this juxtaposition of this symbol of the Buddha and the symbol of Mara. So the symbol of the Buddha represents our own potential to be completely free, our own potential to cultivate patience and love and understanding. And Mara, on the other hand, is also a potential. It's a juxtaposition, if you will. And Mara represents all the forces that hold us back. It's a duality. I read one Buddhist writer who spoke about the Buddha and Mara as being like a shadow. So the Buddha cannot exist without Mara. The two are two sides of a different coin. So we all carry this shadow energy with us. So the fact that Mara keeps reappearing after the Buddha becomes enlightened, right? I think this is really, really interesting. I think this is really interesting. So before enlightenment, here comes Mara. And Mara can perturb the mind. Mara can perturb the heart. Mara can complicate our lives. And we take Mara so seriously. And then we start to whip up all sorts of complications. So Mara's work is very easy for those of us who are not quite enlightened. On the other hand, for the Buddha, Mara has absolutely no sway. It's quite amazing. It's quite amazing. So in terms of this tendency of Mara to get us to fall asleep, there is this process of acceptance that's a very important aspect of the path, where the path of practice, the path towards peace, it requires us to open up to the breadth of our experience, which includes Mara. So this path of including Mara is to actually to befriend Mara. That's easier said than done. And I actually find that poetry really helps in this regard. So I'm going to read this poem by Rumi. It's called The Guest House. And this poem is basically about befriending Mara. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrow who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in.